accession number 14610, reel 2.
But it was so typical of the type of skirmish, type of sort of little firefight, isolated firefight that broke out between Croats and Muslims.
Did you find yourself taking sides, I mean, emotionally with people there?
Yes, we lived in houses just out, the officers that is, in houses just outside the wire of the Vitez sort of camp area. And they were Muslim owned houses. Mm-hmm. The Muslim family who owned the house we lived in, which was quite a nice little villa house, divided into two flats, had balconies, and it was very pleasant. Mm-hmm. They lived in the cattle shed in the garden. Because they were absolutely raking the money in, and who can blame them? I mean, we were paying, the British Army that is, were paying more in terms of rent for that house than I get the rent of my house in Chester. You know, it was quite a bizarre situation. But they decided to live in this one tiny room, probably, you know, 15 by 20 feet, with all their furniture packed in there, all their worldly goods. And the husband was mainly off up at the front line fighting the Serbs. But was very fearful, of course, of his family being ethnically cleansed by Croats. We were right on the...
It's tape number 2. It's Richard Ford Johnston being interviewed by Duncan Anderson. It's the 7th of April, 1994. And there's been a slight gap in between this side and the last side. We've just had a class, and it's now 5 o'clock in the evening. We're both fairly tired, but Richard has very kindly agreed to come back and continue the interview. Richard, you were telling us about your living conditions in Vitez and your relations with the Bosnian family who had actually rented out the house to British forces.
Yeah, I mean, they're very good. The mother in the family used to come up and clean the place, and we used to chat to her and try and give her sort of bits and pieces that one of the ex-ranker officers that lived with us was very adept at getting hold of, no doubt, because of his influence as a former RSM. But I was on the end of the last tip, I was just saying how I came out of the officer's mess one night to look across the road and see houses burning and firefight going on between Croats and Muslims. And in fact, that night we withdrew to our house and basically sat up most of the night playing chess and having the odd drink, but keeping our weapons and flak jackets and helmets close to hand, because word had come through the Croat element, the nearby HVO from up the road, were going to try and storm the row of houses and take them and ethnically cleanse the Muslims from there. And you did tend to side with them to a certain degree, because the Muslims, that is, because they were a fairly ragtag and bobtail outfit when they turned out, and it was more of village militia and shotguns and sort of that type of weapon that they used for maintaining their small holdings and whatever, rather than the Kalashnikovs and ex-JNA, Yugoslav National Army uniforms of the Croats, who were fairly well organised. And to be honest, there was a sort of mafioso element to them. There was a cafe up the road known affectionately as Al Capone's, and the chap who ran it was driven around in a Mercedes. I won't go into the detail, but basically there's a lot of corruption as far as we knew in terms of the Croats, and yet we lived amongst Muslims who just seemed to be normal families, and a lot of their menfolk were away at the front, and often ethnic cleansing occurred when the families were least able to defend themselves. But you know, you can't side with one or the other too much, because they would quite often shell each other's villages. And again, while the menfolk were away, and it was deliberate targeting of women and children. I mean, we quite often saw a multi-barrel rocket launch on the hill a mile behind the camp, and you'd hear the rockets, because of a shortage of ammunition, they'd only fire 3 or 4 barrels at once, but you'd hear them going directly overhead, and they were directly aimed at Croat villages in the valley leading up to Gornji Vukov, and they would fire back. And I once saw fairly heavy calibre rounds impacting against the Muslim house, literally hundreds of yards away from the camp across the river, the Bosna River, which ran past the camp. And of course, the slaughter, the massacres that occurred occurred on both sides, but we saw more evidence of Croat massacre of Muslims because we saw Amici, and that was basically a ceasefire being brokered at a very low level, which is really the only way you could broker a ceasefire because it was such a personal inter-village thing. The commanding officer then decided there was a sort of easing off period and a chance for them to pull back, each side to pull back from the disputed territory just north of Vitez and in the ground between Vitez and Zenica. And so we took a patrol out consisting of some engineer recce, some scimitars of the medium recce who could get up all the routes, and then the commanding officer's warrior, which I in fact was driving at the time, just as a break, by way of a break, because I'm a trained driver. We basically went to drive along the sort of line of confrontation, the sort of no man's land, if you like, between Croat and Muslim forces. It was a beautiful sunny day, and a crowd of Muslims were trudging up this hill track, and eventually we pulled over after going down the side of this column of Armia, that's Armia Bosnia-Herzegovina soldiers. And they crowded round the CO, who was quite a well-known figure to them by this stage, and respected as well, it has to be said. And they said, "You must go to Amici, you must go to Amici, there's been a massacre there." Mm-hmm. And this wasn't very far away. In fact, it was down at the end of the ridge we were traversing at the time, so we went there. And soldiers from the standby platoon of Alex Watts dismounted. Mm-hmm. And the idea was they would move through the village, employing Northern Ireland type training, if you like, basically searching for devices and thereby avoiding them, and also checking for bodies. The buildings were mostly burnt out, although the superstructure was still there, but there was obviously something not right, and the main evidence of this was the toppled minaret, which featured quite highly in the photographs of the area. It was very symbolic, of course, because Amici was reputed to have more religious significance than the other Muslim villages, and that it had its own mosque, and it was meant to be fairly orthodox as opposed to most of the Muslim villages, which were fairly, you know, they were not particularly religious. A lot of the bodies had been removed, although later on we buried 96 in a mass grave. The only two Croat buildings in the village were left standing and fairly unharmed. But basically what they'd done, a small group of Croats, between about 6 and 8 a.m. The previous, or a couple of days earlier, had come through the village, first of all metal beer kegs and the equivalent, full of explosives or incendiary, rolled down the hill from the top of the hill into the village, the upper part of the village, followed by a low-level infantry assault involving posting grenades through windows and shooting whoever exited, and then torching the buildings. Some summary execution, which was probably the menfolk who stayed on the outside or defended the houses upstairs. And in the case of one particular building, the children and the mother had obviously taken refuge in the cellar. It's not clear exactly what happened, but there were bloodstains on the walls, and when we found it, there were skeletons, quite obviously of children, and one adult, probably the mother. I gather it was later discovered it was a female, burned beyond recognition. I mean, they were charred skeletons. The soldiers came out and reported this, and we then took turns to go down and see. It sounds very ghoulish now, but it had to be seen to be believed, and the smell and the whole, it was just so dirty and kind of, I'm trying to think of the words really, just very
squalid.
Yeah, I mean, it was squalid. It was so, one of my memories is of broken tiles and brick dust and bits of wood and the sort of smoke, the dust hanging in the air of this cellar, and these blackened skeletons, mostly the skulls you could see, twisted back over the spine, probably due to the action of the heat, but it gave the impression of the death in hideous agony that no doubt they had suffered. There was evidence that they'd had petrol poured on them, and one only hopes that they were dead before this happened. But, and then the adult male and the younger adolescent, probably a boy, on the steps outside, who had not been so badly burnt, but obviously died either shot or out of hand, or shot defending the place, and then had suffered burns from the burning of the building. And the, horrendously, the animals, the local sort of domestic animals, had either chewed parts of the bodies or carried off bits of them. And it was quite upsetting for the soldiers to find a sort of dismembered limb here and there in an outhouse or part of the building. They'd also slaughtered some of the domestic cattle. Most of these families had one or two of their own, and it was quite bizarre. That was very upsetting. I think a lot of the bandsmen and medics who then came to clear away these bodies, because of course it was felt we had to do something like this, were very terribly upset by having to actually bag up these bodies and remove them. Must have had a great effect on especially the young soldiers, some of whom of course only 18 or so.
Did you have any problems within the battalion or the task force sort of after this?
Well, when we got back, there was no direct evidence of any great problem in terms of that, the kind of traumatising, although there was one soldier who, curiously enough, was a clerk, who actually went off to a hospital in southern Germany shortly after we got back, and nobody could understand, because he'd been in the orderly room most of the time, but had been out on a couple of occasions. Other than that, no, not really. But you know, who can tell? You know, it may take a while to come out. It's still only—it's not even 2 years ago yet.
That's right. Yeah. This was the worst massacre the Cheshire has actually witnessed while they were in.
Yes.
But it was symptomatic of other things which were.
There was definitely the case that it happened on both sides. But this was the worst, the first and worst, and lots of delegates from the UN and the ICRC and such organisations came along. In fact, there was a great party of them that were taken back to see Amici before it was cleared up, which was why it featured so highly in the media.
What sort of coping mechanisms did a Jew and individual unit deploy to deal with these sorts of horrors? I mean, were there any special things that you can remember?
Well, first of all, of course, is the regiment, and not just the regiment, the bonding that had gone on in the battalion group. I mean, obviously, it was not just Cheshire's. The greatest bonding I noticed was between Cheshire's and Royal Irish Regiment soldiers. We had a company of them. I had a signal platoon of 34, and in fact 17 of them were, so exactly half, were Royal Irish, to make up numbers. And they got on terribly well with our soldiers, and that helped an awful lot. But specifically coping and dealing with the situation, when we returned to Fallingbostel, the battalion did not go on leave immediately. There was a 3 or 4 day gap, I can't quite remember which, but at least 3 days between the last main body flight, getting back actually into camp, and then everybody going on leave at once, during which time it was relaxed. There were no drill parades, there was very low level training. Obviously the boys weren't just allowed to sit on their on their pits, but it was very much relaxed, and you know, timings were quite sort of, you know, slack. And basically just so that the bonding would continue and people would have a chance to start adjusting before bomb bursting back to UK on leave. And it was a very good idea, and I think it worked very well. Mm. And to be honest, it was fine. There was no sort of great hurry. Obviously, the married people were able to be with their immediate families immediately on getting back. I suppose those who had girlfriends back in the UK wanted to get back there, but I think they appreciated the need to actually hang around for a while and adjust. And then, you know, we had a whole month as well. Now, we were only supposed to get, I think, 2 weeks or something, but a special extension was applied for, not just for the battalion, for everybody. And we got a month, which was excellent. You know, you needed that, because the first 2 weeks, it would still be winding down. You needed then another 2 weeks to start building relations back up, because, of course, they do. Wives left back in Germany, for example, do tend to build their own life. And that was part of the problem, I think.
And trying to explain to people what you had seen and what
yes, happened. That's right. A lot of the time there was a reluctance to talk about it at first, and you don't want to articulate, not particularly because you don't want to share it, but there is an element of, you know, well, I can only talk about this to other soldiers. You don't understand. There was definitely an element of that. And a slight resentment as well at this sort of misunderstanding of the situation, which I still feel sometimes. Like I know it's you can't blame people for not understanding, but I do get a little bit impatient. And curiously enough, I get impatient when people say, "Oh God, it must have been awful, the whole thing." And I say, "Well, no, it wasn't actually, because you don't understand. I was with my family, my extended family, my regiment, and that to me is, you know." I shared a room with a guy who I'd served with for 5 or 6 years, who was the adjutant, in fact, Richard Waltier. I still, he's away at the moment from the regiment. I'm away from the regiment, but we will serve again together. We will maintain our friendship. And that's the same with everybody throughout the whole battalion. It's very, very important.
One thing that intrigues me is that this is a very difficult situation for soldiers to be in, to have to witness these things and not be able to do anything about them because you're acting under UN orders. Do you personally find this difficult, of being constantly having to restrain yourself?
Well, I wasn't actually presented with the problem that much, to be honest, because I was so much part of the battle group headquarters and the personal staff of the commanding officer. But on occasions such as the incident in Busavacha, I had a coaxially mounted machine gun on top of my vehicle. I wanted to cock it and not start firing back, but be ready to. And that certainly gave me the indication that the soldiers must have felt like that at the times when they were shot at. I mean, there was, I think for the first 3 months of the tour, there was not a single day when a British soldier, one of our battalion group, was not shot at or mortared. And I think they did get very frustrated. I did not feel that myself. As I say, I wasn't out that much, but I can imagine it must have been hard.
To me, when chaps are travelling around in Warriors, do they decorate the interior of the Warriors, like tanks, for example, with personal posters and?
No, rather difficult. The trouble with Warriors, it is so packed. I mean, 10 men.
Right.
Which, yeah. I mean, not they didn't always deploy with 10 men. Obviously, usually only a couple in the back, but they occasionally did, and often the whole crew's kit were packed in the. The netting. I mean, the old 4-3-2, it might have been possible, a bit more room, but the Warrior, very little turret space and very little space in the back. They tended to go more for not decorating the outside of them, but they certainly had their company insignia, which was for our A company, for example, was the Ace of Spades, not to be confused with the Death Card, which was, some people thought that was what it was at first. It was not, it was just a play on the Ace. B Company was the B, and they had a hovering Bumblebee,
yeah.
Intertwined with the letter B, and C Company with the bayonet, which has always been their symbol.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that was their sort of way of achieving identity.
Yeah. Now, the entire battalion had had reasonably recent experience in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find this Northern Ireland experience of any great benefit to you in Bosnia?
Yes, I think so. I think everybody did. There's been a tendency to sort of try and shy away, certainly in the training establishments who deal with this, to shy away from making comparisons to Northern Ireland. I can see the danger of it, but there are a lot of things in the training which coincide and which are valid, obviously. I mean, you're dealing with a situation where you are trying to maintain law and order. The role of the army in Northern Ireland is assistance to the RUC and maintenance of law and order. I mean, it could be said that, you know, the role of the British Battalion Group as the... word escapes me. UN Protection Force, was, you know, assistance to the UN and the ICRC and the various other agencies in maintenance of law and order, protection and distribution of aid. So, you know, and you've got belligerents, you know, Croats and Muslims, as opposed to loyalists and Republican terrorists. Mm. So, to get back to the actual point of training, the dealing with not touching, you know, things, patrolling skills, you know, dealing with people, reacting to incidents, giving first aid, buddy-buddy system type, and all those sorts of skills and drills, very much so, yeah.
I got the impression that part of the role of the Cheshires, or at least part of the role of the commanding officer decided the Cheshires would perform, was actually establishing a British classic counterinsurgency policy, winning hearts and minds, you know, throughout the area of responsibility. Would this be a fair...
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a case of doing things on two levels, if you like. There was the level at which negotiations and UN work was carried out in terms of a military aid in pursuit of a political solution, or to assist in the finding of a political solution. Mm. But there was definitely the very low level village G5 humanitarian stuff. Absolutely so. In fact, in the absence of a mission, because Colonel Stewart was quite adamant about the fact that he'd not been given a proper mission, certainly early on in the tour, he decided that he would pursue the spirit of what he'd been told to do, which was to, you know, pursue this assistance and protection of humanitarian aid convoys. But it didn't stop, you know, at that. It went further and lower down to G5 at a local level, you know, distribution of aid, to orphanages, to hospitals, which were obviously very vulnerable places in a civil war, right down to route maintenance, and, you know, being almost on call if, you know, there was a cry for help from some quarter, regardless of which persuasion there were, you know, we would go. Let me see an example. An example would probably be during the breakout of major hostility between Croats and Muslims in Vitez in April 93. Mm-hmm. There was a tanker bomb, very similar again to a Northern Ireland type situation, a proxy bomb, with some unfortunate Muslim who was handcuffed to the wheel of a tanker. He was forced to drive into Vitez, into the Muslim area, the end nearest our camp, right by the mosque, and then this gigantic incendiary, basically, probably a small amount of explosive and a large amount of fuel, went up, detonated God knows how, leaving a 20-foot crater in the middle of the road, wrecking four houses down to ground level, and severely damaging the mosque 100 metres away. A very big bang, and lots of injuries and lots of bodies lying around. an A company immediately deployed into Vitez in the middle of the night in a very confused situation, mm-hmm. With a great deal of potential for a follow-up of some kind, and basically sorted the situation out, Kazovac people to hospital, our own and the hospitals in the nearby towns. Extracted bodies and buried them where possible, and basically dealt with the situation. I believe is the basis for Martin Thomas, the company commander, later being awarded the MBE. Right. I listened to the transmissions of that company mm-hmm. As I was off on another job in a village over towards Zenica. Mm-hmm. And out of professional interest, I was listening as the signals officer. As I was on the move, I was listening to the radio, net discipline and that sort of thing. And it was a never-ending buzz of conversation and, or rather, interaction between the various elements of A Company as they went about this task. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. They really were getting to grips with it and the situation there. And it just showed the slickness of the drills they got to by that stage. That, to be honest, was another example. The place we're moving to mm-hmm. was a Croat village which had been threatened by a Muslim extremist group from the area of Zenica, and they mm-hmm. said they were going to storm the village that night. Mm-hmm. And the local Catholic priest got in touch with our padre and had said, look, can you do anything for us? So again, Battlegroup headquarters and an interpreter, Neil Greenwood, who's in fact on this JDSC with us, mm-hmm. A Serbo-Croat speaker. We went down there literally with three vehicles, I think it was, the mm-hmm. my vehicle, the command vehicle and an engineer vehicle, and about 20 of us. And we literally parked up outside the church, which was the centre of the village, probably about 20 buildings, and literally made a presence to ward off any potential aggressor, but we didn't know quite what to expect. We didn't go outwardly hostile. I mean, we could have taken warrior with, you know, armament. In fact, all we had was pintly mounted GPMGs. We didn't actually man them all night. We mounted sentries and a radio stag and literally just guessed that our presence would put off any potential aggressor, the white vehicles, the sort of the thin white line. Mm. I don't know if it worked. I mean, how could you say? But nothing happened. That was the kind of thing, though, that you know we did.
The thin white line, was that actually an expression you used about yourselves? There,
no, mm-hmm. but it's not my. It's not originally from me. I don't know where it comes from.
Right. I know that you know you're very busy and you've got to prepare for exams, and there are really only three more questions at this stage, although later on I'd like to ask you a lot more when we have more time. The first of these questions actually concerns the other UN forces. What did you think of them? I mean, were you in contact with
me personally, or the general feeling?
The general feeling.
Right.
I won't put you on the spot.
No, I mean, I'll give you both very quickly, but the general feeling, of course, was at best grudging respect, at worst utter contempt. Mm-hmm. Shall we say the classic case of what you don't know, you tend to slag off the most. Mm-hmm. And in cases like the Ukrainian battalion and the Egyptian battalion in Sarajevo, mm-hmm. because we had very little contact with them, but heard stories of them, they tended to come under a great deal of criticism. Now, examples include the fact that the Egyptian battalion virtually had to stay in throughout the winter and not do much because they didn't take winter clothing. They were in almost jungle fatigue, and it was literally too cold for them to operate effectively. Yeah. Ukrainian battalion, I think, were under very strict control because, of course, recent breakup of the Soviet Union mm-hmm. and the hangover from that. Closer to us, the Dutch transport battalion at nearby Busabacha. This is where my personal feelings come in, but I think it was they were generally more well thought of. And again, that comes down to increased communication and knowledge of them. They spoke English so well, most of them. And the Dutch have, I think, a very much more